Good afternoon and welcome to Lunch with Leaders. I'm Cindy Morgan, the Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development, and I'm just thrilled that you're here. Lunch with Leaders, for those of you who are new, it's a space where we can come together as leaders across Penn Medicine to be in community, to continue learning from each other, as well as from our esteemed guests. We love hearing from you in the chat, so we hope you'll participate actively throughout today's session. If you are new, or if you've missed a few of the back episodes of Lunch with Leaders, all of them can be found on the Lead Strong webpage. So I hope that you'll get the word out there with us. So it's been a minute since our last show, and the mailbag was filled with compliments. So we were so happy that we focused on adaptive leadership in the face of adversity. We had on Fran Johnston from the Telios Institute, Dr. Deb Driscoll, and Sheila Kemp, CNO at Princeton. They were so good, weren't they? For those of you who watched, we heard really positive feedback about the authenticity that each of those leaders showed in talking about their own challenges during leading during this time. And boy, you in the chat on fire. So I was really appreciative for those who participated and for those who came. I think that there were some good tips to share, as well as just a general feeling of camaraderie as we managed through some of these challenging times together. Special thanks to Anira Kudaswamy for her kind words, and as well as those who took the time to give us feedback via the survey, text messages, emails. We love hearing from you, so thank you so much. We actually found a great HBR article that we thought would be a good follow-up, and it's worth the read. So G's going to post it in the chat. It's called A New Era for Mental Health at Work. So listen, if you missed this show, you don't have to miss it. You can go to the Lead Strong webpage. We'll put the link in there. It's a great one to watch for yourself to just honor where you're at right now, as well as maybe even include some of the members of your team and have a discussion with it afterwards. So we've got some great commercials today and some things to highlight. Youngin, how are you? Take it away.
Hi, Cindy. Great to see everyone. Thank you for joining us. So a few announcements. The Penn's Way is well underway until November 19th. This year, we have the goal of raising $1.6 million in three pillars: healthcare disparity, food insecurity, and social justice. I just love the theme. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Every dollar counts, and there's even raffles and prizes for just giving. So let's do this. Let's go far together. Next slide. And thank you for all those who joined the book club last week. It's really worth rewatching if you missed it. So we have it in recording, in broadcast, so you can enjoy while you're going for a walk or going for a run. And stay tuned for the next one on December 1st. There'll be more communication coming out soon. The PMX week is coming up, and we also have 30-minute coach dedicated to this year's theme, which is being empowered. Our next Lunch with Leaders will also feature the Penn Medicine experience, and I'd love to invite you to attend the 30-minute coach to understand what it means as an individual and as manager as you empower others. So don't miss it. The CMEs, make sure you have an active profile in the CME system, link with your name, credentials, and cell number, and text in today's code, which is 7309522153986728. It's important you have the profile in the system. You can text in now for the next 24 hours. The event handout is on the Lead Strong website. And if you have any problems, you know, you can reach out directly to the CME office. Thank you again. And now sit back with your lunch and enjoy.
Thanks, Youngin. Just going to give a big shout out to the Penn Medicine Fellows who are running the Penn's Way campaign. Felicia, Iodelli, Philip, Matt, Ethan, they rock. We can do this together, so let's make sure we're all participating and contributing to our community. And now let's talk about today's session because it's going to be great. So back in July, it feels like a lifetime ago with COVID time being how it is. But back in July, when the world opened up, PMA worked with our executives to plan and facilitate a retreat for about 50 leaders at the Inn at Penn. And the topic was all around value-based healthcare. And the intention of this session was really to lay out how and why Penn Medicine is moving in this direction of value-based care. Kevin Mahoney, our CEO, kicked off the retreat by assuring participants that we're not abandoning our very successful strategy of being really stellar in research and advanced cutting-edge care. Rather, we need to understand our success in this value space, population health, primary care, and ensure that we have the infrastructure to accommodate all types of care so we're ultimately serving our entire community. And it was a key message, and the retreat was a massive success. And the number one piece of feedback that we heard coming out of the retreat was that participants really wanted their leadership team members to hear these key messages from our leaders around value-based care and how do we get even more ready and capitalize on the successes that we've already had to expand. So today's show is an attempt to recreate some of that initial magic. And we have three of the principal leaders at Penn Medicine who focus on value at Penn to educate us all on the components of value-based care, where we're heading, how do we help to catalyze our teams for change and learn even more so we're even better ready to deliver this strategy. And you know what? We're going to even bust a few value-based care myths while we're at it. So these are our objectives of what we're hoping to accomplish. I really love hearing from you. And this is a topic where you really can ask the experts anything here. So I want you to make sure you're putting your thoughts, feelings, your experience, and any questions that you have in the chat. And I'll try to make sure we get as many to the guests as possible. So tough time. So let me hear how you're doing. Let's get our phones out. I want to hear your word. Let's check in. So let's do a quick anonymous poll. Using your cell, text Penn Medicine 918-22-333. Then you'll be in the survey. If you have any problems, let G know in the chat. Hi, G. Good to be with you today. What emotions are you feeling today? Text me your word. I'm eager to hear how you're doing. While you're giving me your word, it's my absolute pleasure to introduce our three guests today. Roy Schwartz, who is our Vice President of Managed Care and Payer Relations, Dr. Mitch Schnall, another guest who's been on Lunch with Leaders before, so he knows what to do. He's our Chair and Department of Radiology, and Dr. Matt Press, he is the Physician Executive for Penn Primary Care, as well as the Medical Director of Penn Primary Care Service Line. So Matt, Mitch, Roy, join me on camera. I'm so glad to have you here. All right, let's see how people are doing. Overwhelmed is sort of the overwhelm. Oh, overwhelmed, tired, smiley face. Frazzled. That's a great word. I am sorry you're feeling that way though. Busy. I feel that. Curious, optimistic, humble. Matt Press, do these words surprise you? What do you think?
No, I think this reflects the way we're all feeling, and it's actually really reassuring to see that we're sharing in this experience.
Well, Dr. Bob Vonderhyde is excited, so he may be having a different type of experience than many of you. Bob, good to see you. Thanks for coming out. So thanks for sharing. We're feeling you. I want to send you good energy right here through the screen. And I hope that you'll feel a little inspired by Lunch with Leaders and our great panelists today. So maybe, Casey, can you, let me ask Roy. Let's start with you, Roy. Thanks for all your leadership in this space. We're really grateful for your deep expertise and all that you do with our various payers to get us great partnerships in the community. Set the stage. Talk to us about value-based care. What are the components that define a value-based care program? Can you walk us through?
Sure, happy to do that. The concept behind value-based care and value-based payment is pretty simple and straightforward. It's the idea of creating payment models and complementary care models that focus rather than on the volume of services that are being provided, meaning rewarding us for providing more and more care. It's instead orienting towards paying for the value of care, meaning the quality, the outcomes, cost efficiency of the care being delivered. And so it's a relatively straightforward concept. I think The healthcare industry is famous for taking simple, straightforward comments and making the problems and making the solutions super complicated. And so there are uncountable numbers of value-based payment models out there that work in all sorts of different ways. But up on the screen, you can see a few of the different value-based payment models that Penn participates in today. So walking through them might help give a better example of what value-based payment and care looks like. There's generally two different flavors, one that's primary care attributed, and I'll describe what that means, and another that is hospital and specialist attributed. The idea of attribution or attributed basically is pointing to the concept that value-based care tends to focus on populations of patients rather than the individual patient, and trying to maximize the best quality clinical and cost outcomes for those whole populations. So how do you define a population? It's through ways of attributing those individual patients to that larger group. So primary care attribution is the idea of looking at the primary care panels, the patients that are associated, that are involved with and cared by primary care practices, and pooling them together as a single population under the concept that the primary care practice and all the services that wrap around that primary care practice can be the medical home for the patient and begin to take more accountability for the overall cost as well as healthcare for that population. Medicare has a longstanding program called the Medicare Shared Savings Program. Out in Lancaster, out in Princeton, we participate in those programs. Medicare direct contracting is a relatively new program. We're considering it very seriously. It's similar to Medicare Shared Savings, but it's a much more easier plan to operate inside of, because you can not only take accountability for the populations, but you can begin to influence some of the Medicare benefits. You can define networks yourself inside of it that allow you to really wrap around, take care of the patients, and sort of create incentives for doing so. We participate in commercial shared savings programs, meaning not through Medicare, but through the commercial insurance plans like Aetna, Independence Blue Cross, Highmark, Horizon Blue Cross. Again, Lancaster and Princeton participate in a fairly large portfolio of these shared savings programs. Right now at Penn, we participate in Independence Blue Cross's Total Value of Care program. These are commercial populations, again, attributed by their relationship to the primary care doc that rewards Penn for quality and outcomes, as well as shares in the shared savings associated with delivering care more efficiently, reducing cost for the population. On the other side, there are attribution models that are not related to primary care. They could be related to specific populations of surgical patients. Total joint replacement is a common example across the country. We do it fairly extensively in all regions at Penn Medicine, where we look at the population of joint replacement patients, take accountability for their care from the time they get their surgery to 3 months after their surgery, and all of the care that might take place in there, and subacute rehab, outpatient rehab, emergency room visits, readmissions, all become our accountability. So in Medicare, we participate, as well as with a handful of commercial plans as well. There are other models that are out there. Medicare has a broad incentive payment system called MIPS, a merit-based incentive payment system, that almost all docs in the country participate in. And it basically is simply an incentive program that measures care success on a bunch of different dimensions and pays out rewards associated with it. We did a unique agreement with Independence Blue Cross about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, around warrantying their readmission. So an Independence Blue Cross member that gets readmitted within 30 days from an admission, an initial admission of Penn, we're warrantying, essentially saying IBC and the patient don't have to make any payment for that. We'll take accountability for it. in the overall care of our patients. Commercial episodes of care, I talked about the total joint, again, is a good example of that, where commercial plans are pretty much following suit with what Medicare has done. So those are some examples, but I think it might better illustrate what value-based payment and care models mean.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. If we go to the next slide, how different is it from how we provide care and are reimbursed today? How deep is this?
Yeah, so there was a book that was very popular years ago. I assume it's still relatively popular, called How to Lie with Statistics. And and I bring that up because I'm frequently asked the question, so how much value-based care do we do today? What percent of our business is value-based care? How much of our revenue is value-based care? And those answers can vary greatly depending on how you think about it. Often we'll look at, what percentage of Penn's overall revenue is driven by just the incentive payments we get out of those value-based programs, the specific checks we get for having performed well. That's relatively small. Percentage of revenue that comes from value-based incentive payments is less than 2% for the health system. But that's a misleading statistic because on the higher end, the question might be, when we're treating a patient, are they involved in a value-based payment model? And that broadens the answer greatly because most of our Medicare patients are part of that MIPS program I described. Many of our Medicare patients are in an episode of care that we are contracted with Medicare. The total value of care or these ACO programs capture every single, almost every single patient that is associated with our primary care practices. So those numbers, I have greater than 30%. It may be approaching 40% of our patients are actually already touched by a value-based program. When you think about our margin as a health system, which is a much smaller number than our actual total revenue, it becomes much more impactful to think about those incentives. So that less than 2% that we're getting strictly in the incentive payments, when you look at it as a percentage of our actual margin, we're now talking about almost 25% health system operating margin is supported by these value-based incentive programs. And as I was describing earlier, all the way up to 100% when you think about the revenue, the percentage of our margin compared to all of the revenue that we get for the patients that are touched by these value-based programs, it's actually greater than 100%. So there's a lot of ways to answer that question, but I think the important message to get across is it's already significant at Penn, and it's just going to grow over the next few years.
Thanks. That's really helpful framing. It leads me to my next question. Matt, let me ask you, I remember this college professor of mine taught theater appreciation. He got up with a mirror and he smashed the mirror with a hammer and there were shards of glass on the mirror and he held it up and it was refracting light everywhere. And he made the point, what you see depends upon your point of view. For some people, they're way deep in this. And some of the stats that Roy just talked about really point to the fact that this is so not new. And yet there are some other leaders here who may not be so impacted by this quite yet. Can you tell me about some of your experiences, your key learnings, and some of our successes that we've had at Penn Medicine in leading in this space?
Sure. So I think it's important to differentiate with value-based care what it is and what it isn't. And what it is what Roy just described. There's metrics around quality and cost of care and different programs and different ways to be paid. But equally important is what it isn't, which is it isn't the traditional way of getting paid in healthcare, which is for every widget, for every test, procedure, visit, that's what you're paid on. Value-based care is more than that. Value-based care fills in all the spaces of care outside of those traditional transactional or widget-based way of paying for healthcare, fee for service. So to me, what that means, because it is value-based care, isn't tied to each individual widget, it allows us to be much more proactive and flexible in the way we deliver care. So the proactive part means that we are accountable for a population, whether it's in a specialty episode or a hospital episode or a primary care attributed population, we're accountable. And so therefore, we can't sit back and wait for the patient to come to us, wait for their issue to get to a point that they need to bring it to us. We are proactive, and through the way value-based care pays, we get rewarded and incentivized to do this. We're proactive in managing patients' conditions before they escalate, before the things become discoordinated. And then value-based care allows us to be flexible in that if we can think of what best meets the patient's needs. In some ways, value-based care is as precision medicine as our most sophisticated Dr. Von der Heide genetic testing, treatment protocols. It's precision in that we don't have to be bound by the confines of an RVU by a specific visit. We have the flexibility to think about new ways of delivering care. And because of the way the payment works, because of what value-based care is, we can fund those types of activities. So just to give you a concrete example, in my world in primary care, you know, we have the largest primary care network in the region of almost 100 primary care practices from Lancaster to Princeton and everything in between. I mean, as Roy mentioned, all of our patients, over 500,000 patients who have Penn primary care physicians, are in some form of a value-based payment or value-based care arrangement. And so for us, that means creating what is called in primary care, but it extends to other specialties, a medical home. This is where the patient's home is, this is their home base, and we are proactive in coordinating their care, we are proactive in managing their conditions, and we are flexible in that we can deliver care in different ways with an expanded team, people with different skill sets, different professions, to best meet that patient's need. So the one example, we've got several examples, but the one I'll give to you right now is our integrated mental health program in primary care. So we knew 4 or 5 years ago that we wanted to move our primary care practices in this direction. And we also knew that the prevalence of mental health conditions in our patients was large and growing, that the ability for those patients and their primary care physicians to access quality mental health services was extremely limited. And there fortunately has been a lot of research, much of which had been done at Penn by folks in the Department of Psychiatry, to create a model of care that puts mental health services into primary care. So we can all generally access our primary care physician pretty easily when we have an issue, a sore throat, an ear infection, high blood pressure. But when we have mental health issues, we can't access the mental health system with that level of convenience. By putting mental health services into primary care, we're bringing that access and convenience to our patients in a setting that's comfortable and convenient for them. And we've been able to do that, and really were the impetus to develop that was our participation in one of these Medicare value-based payment programs. And so that was a good early model of care that was proactive and flexible. And we've had great success in terms of patient outcomes. And really importantly, we've had great success in terms of our primary care physicians feeling that now they have access to high quality mental health care for their patients.
And, you know, Matt, we could probably spend a half an hour talking about all the obstacles that used to exist, the fee-for-service model that prevented all of that kind of access and all of that kind of care. I mean, there was multiple structural issues in basic fee-for-service that hinders that kind of access.
And I will say, and I know we're going to get to the myths in a bit, but it's not either or, fee for service or value. And in fact, this mental health program is a perfect example of that. We actually fund this mental health program through fee for service billing codes. They're different because they're not tied to a visit. They're over the course of a month. That's time based. It's a team approach. It doesn't all the work doesn't have to be done by the physician or advanced practice provider. But yet we have surrounded that program with other what we call care management resources, with nursing, pharmacy, social work, et cetera, to coordinate with and support that program. And that's exclusively funded through participation in value-based payments. So this sort of mixed payment world, that's why I focus, you know, the finance piece is obviously critical. But to me, what this value-based care means is flexibility, so that we can take a little piece of funding from here and a little piece of funding from here, put it together and create this kind of an innovative program.
Thanks so much. Mitch, we've talked and hinted a little bit about some of the myths. For those who are new, they may have some misconceptions upon hearing about this. Would you talk us through some of these myths and maybe bust them while you're at it?
Sure, happy to bust some myths. So one of the things that, as Matt just referred to, is we hear a lot about, you know, it's an either or. And it really isn't an either or. And in fact, we're betting on the fact that we're going to be pursuing a strategy that, you know, both includes value-based care strategy and a fee-for-service strategy. We just heard an example of how they can work together. But, you know, we do, I think, have to have a single sort of ethic and driving force of value. But we can certainly have multiple payment models working together. And in fact, you know, talking to one of the groups that have been very successful in value-based care, they relate the fact that they actually play off each other. And that is that when you're negotiating fee-for-service rates, if you have documentation that you have great value performance and perform really well on value programs, that actually gives you a little bit more leverage to be able to get premium fee-for-service rates. So they even relate to each other. And we expect on one end to be managing populations out in primary care, on the other hand, to be doing very high-end tertiary care with where we're going to demand high fee-for-service rates and have that together as part of our strategy. We also hear that, you know, we're not in the business of managing risk. This is insurance companies. Well, guess what? We're managing risk already, right? You know, if we think about inpatient services and DRGs, right, we're managing the risk of those patients that have, you know, various complexity that come in under the same DRG. We're already starting to manage risk in the outpatient world with bundles, as Roy just pointed out, in population management programs and other incentive programs, so that we're already in this business. And I think going forward, we're going to see this more of a partnership between payers and providers than simply a payer or provider process of managing risk. You know, the next two I'm going to sort of take together. You know, this is just a fad. I hear this. In fact, I just gave a talk out at UCSD, and this is exactly a question I was asked. Well, why is it different? We hear about this all the time. You know, part of this, number one, is how far it's gone. You know, this is already, you know, gone fairly far. As we've heard from Roy, it touches a large part of our a patient population involved in one of these value programs, but it's also who's driving it and what's happened in the medical funding and payment market, right? So these days, you know, a lot of the medical insurance market is actually self-insured large businesses. And so if you were to talk to a insurance company and you know, we've had conversations recently as part of negotiation with one of our large payers, they talk about, their administrative services population and their fully insured population. The administrative services population really are businesses that are self-insured, and the insurance company is just administering it for them. And in fact, all of you are likely in a similar plan where your insurance is either through the health system or through the university, even though you may think you're insured through one of the large insurance companies of IBC or whatever, you're really insured by Penn. And these businesses are what's driving this. These businesses are demanding value. They're pushing insurance companies for value. This is now up to almost half of insurance companies' business these days, and so they're responding. And so this isn't being driven necessarily by government policy or government policy supporting it. It may not be driven even by the insurance companies. It's really driven by large business that's demanding more value for the money they're spending. And that's, I think, fundamentally different than what we've seen in the past. You know, and is this just a way for for big insurance companies to pay us less. No, they're responding to their customers, which are these large businesses. That being said, you know, I learned a ton in the recent negotiation we did with one of our large carriers that Roy beautifully orchestrated. We went to that carrier and said, look, as an organization at Penn Medicine, we need to see certain increases over the next few years. They didn't argue. They were fine. They were fine with supporting those. The question was, how are we going to get those increases? And what they did is they wanted to shift more of the payments into value programs away from traditional fee-for-service programs in response to what they're being asked to do by their customers, the large businesses that either ask them to administrate programs or pay them for insurance. And so it wasn't a matter of how much they paid us. It was a matter of how they were going to pay us. And in fact, under this new contract, we have a significant upside if we change some behavior and perform a little bit better and can actually win as opposed to where we would have been in a pure fee-for-service arrangement with this group. And frankly, that's part of the reason we're into this. We're interested in this because we see it as a way for the health system to win. The last one, value-based care applies to community providers, not academic health systems like ours. It applies to all providers, both community primary care as well as academic specialty care. And in fact, we hope and believe one of our special sauces is going to be the incredible expertise we have in our subspecialty academic physicians who can help to design care models and support care across the network in ways that will bring tremendous value to our patients, our providers, and our payers. And so we think that we all have to be in this together in order to be successful. And it's not just a community or it's not just a primary care program.
Thanks so much, Mitch. What I really appreciate what you said. And in so many ways, this is a strategy. And if we can really get great at working with our partners to deliver care in this way, it could be a competitive advantage for us as well. Give a shout out to Maureen Hetu, IT in the house. Matt, she asked a question that I'm interested in asking also around how does this model of care benefit the patient? And in particular, she asked, I heard other organizations refer to value-based care as a shift from payment for illness to payment for health. Is that generally true? What are the patient benefits?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll go back to these two terms that I mentioned earlier, proactive and flexible. So right now in the standard, the standard model or the status quo in most healthcare systems across the country, I'll take primary care, for example, you have the same set of resources, meaning the same time with a physician, the same length of time with a physician, the same level of expertise, whether you're a 20-year-old with a twisted ankle or you're an 80-year-old with 10 chronic medical conditions. That obviously just doesn't make sense. And so when we think about flexibility, we want to have flexibility in being able to spend more time with the elderly patient who's trying to stay at home and struggling with maintaining their independence and managing multiple chronic conditions. We want the flexibility to bring in other resources, mental health resources, pharmacists, management of high-risk medications. And so the benefit to the patient is that we can construct a care team and care interventions that best meet the patient's needs. Another great example is a partnership, and I want to mention that the mental health program is a partnership between primary care and our Department of Psychiatry, and just want to shout out to Dr. Anderson and Dr. Kendo and others who have been incredible partners. But I'll give another shout out to another great partner, which is Dr. Schnall in the Department of Radiology. So we launched about maybe a year and a half ago something called e-consults. And this allows any provider in the system, primary care or specialist, to access about a dozen different expert specialists at Penn with a specific question. So normally if I saw a patient and I had a particular question that I was struggling to manage on my own, I would either refer that patient to a specialist and have them go through this process of scheduling an appointment, driving to the visit, parking, all of that, or I would reach out to a friend who's a specialist and say, hey, can you help me out? Help me answer this question. What eConsults does is it formalizes that process, but in most cases can save the patient a visit to the specialist, save them the convenience. And what happens is I ask a question through Epic, through PenChart, and shout out to our PenChart folks who helped support this. I ask a question through PenChart, and the specialist reviews the chart and gets back to me within 48 hours with an answer, and then I can provide that to that direction to the patient. Maybe it does require a visit, and I say, hey, you really do need a visit with the specialist because of X, Y, and Z reasons. But in about two-thirds of cases, it doesn't, and I'm able to implement whatever recommendation the specialist said. So we have it in about 12 specialties, and I want to call out Dr. Schnall in the Department of Radiology. I'm not aware of any other institution in the country that is doing e-consults with radiology, and I think everybody on this call knows that radiology and our radiology services have gotten more complex in terms of different types of, as the technology has advanced, we've got many different types of radiology services, and the interpretation has gotten more advanced. They're picking up other findings that maybe not related to what the test was initially looking for. So the Department of Radiology created an e-consult program with us. So now, and I would say I'm using this sometimes once a day, putting in an e-consult, which goes to one of Mitch's radiologists. That radiologist will review a study, answer my question, get back to me, and that's specialty expertise, that's pen level advanced medicine that we're putting in every community throughout the region through our primary care practices with this e-consult. To me, that's value-based care, that's the kind of innovation it enables, and that's the kind of program that has direct benefit to patients.
Thanks. There is just a lot of love going on. Mitch, big shout out to you. Big shout out to Jenny Bencardino, Radiology Rocks. Big shout out to Dr. Anderson, who said, "Pen integrated care, right on. That's awesome." So a lot of love being shown. Really appreciate that. Susan Crow from LG says she personally had a wonderful e-consult experience as a patient and how much of a game changer it is. So even us as patients are getting the service around this, which can help us so often. Mitch and Matt, let me ask you a question. Dr. Jason Acrivo, a pulmonologist at HUP, wrote in. By the way, we love it when you write in with the questions. It makes my job as facilitator so much easier. It's a hard one. How's Penn going to support the value of outpatient teams who spend significant time caring for complex medical patients? This can be time-consuming, low revenue generating, but can have a significant effect on avoiding rehospitalizations. I want to also just say that Jeff Milstein, another one of our physicians, wrote in a value-based model, how do we address important but less easily measured behaviors like effective communication, connection with patients? So I think we're seeing some themes here. I'd also just say Dr. Dan Sofer wrote in and talked a little bit about this hands-on physician time with their patients. As physician leaders, can you talk to us about how you're kind of grasping with some of these changes?
Matt, you want to take your first shot at it?
Yeah, sure, I'll start. We're in a transition period right now. We, as a health system, Penn Medicine, and as a national health system, have spent 50 plus years in a model that confines the work we do, at least the work we do that's reimbursed, to specific visits, procedures, tests. And we all did a lot of work outside of that. And that's not just physicians and advanced practice providers. That's every member of the care team in and off, including the front desk. We all did a lot of work coordinating care, following up with patients. And that was all unreimbursed. And so as we built an operational infrastructure, it made it hard to invest in that work, all the glue that happens outside of the individual transaction or interaction with the patient. And so the more we move into this value-based care world, the more it's on us to start to build the clinical operations and operational structure to formally support those activities. So that means, again, proactive. That means not waiting for the patient with a chronic condition to schedule that next appointment in the office, but for our care team to reach out proactively and and identify that the patient is at risk, we need to bring them in. And again, the flexibility of bringing in other care team members. So, you know, I think what Jeff and Dan and others are getting at is that's what we're driving for. That's we want to preserve this relationship between provider and patient. We want to preserve and support all of the activities that go on around the individual widgets of care, so to speak. And that's going to be a bit of a tough transition. But as Roy said, we're in it already. We're doing it already. I gave a couple examples, but there's dozens more in every department across Penn Medicine and every specialty. And so I think having some, you all and those questions have identified some true north principles for what we need to keep in mind as we start to refine and remodel our care processes to support and drive towards those true north principles.
Thanks so much, Matt. Mitch, I want to add, I would like to hear your answer also, because I think these are really important conversations. I'd also ask Elizabeth Wenzel in the chat said, are we able to capture any of this complicated outpatient management as cost avoidance, maybe even in hospitalization avoidance? Thoughts on this overall general line of questioning?
Sure. So number one, just to answer the specific question, yeah, as we start taking on more and more population risk, if we keep patients out of the hospital, we win, right? And that win will come ultimately in dollars. And so we've got to figure out this whole new economy in this new space of value-based care. But I want to amplify, you know, something that Matt said, and that is, you know, this isn't, you know, we've lived in a world where in fee-for-service, we get paid per widget, per you know, per event, and we've pushed volume, and we've looked to try to make each of those events as efficient as we can to try to limit as much activity to billable events as possible in order to be effective. And I think we've created that situation where we all feel pushed and don't feel that connection to patients anymore. And so I think, you know, as we have more and more of our reimbursement not necessarily tied directly to those events, and we have dollars coming in any other ways, I take it as a challenge to us to use our creativity, right, to try to figure out how we use those resources to reinvent how we care for patients so that, you know, it hits some of those sort of true north, you know, tenets that Matt was talking about, and, you know, takes care of patients well, gets them to where they need to be, allows providers to be practicing at the highest end of their license, and gives them great satisfaction in what they're doing, and provides the opportunity for us to be able to have those connections with patients. So I would turn it back on the Penn community to say, this is an opportunity, right? And we've got to figure this opportunity out, and we got to be the winners in it. And the winners will ultimately be our patients and us as well.
Thanks. I think that's really well said, and it gives me a lot of hope as we expand this. I also recognize that there's some change in change management. Matt, have there been learnings that you can share around how you've driven some of these strategies with your teams, and learnings that you can share around getting people more ready for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, having conversations like this is really important. We can get lost in the weeds of the technical details of how the payment works very quickly. We can get lost in some of Mitch's myth busters and, you know, is this true? Is this not true? And so, you know, having these conversations to get people more comfortable and familiar with some of these concepts is I think, an important step number one. I think step number two, as Mitch said, is, you know, coming together as a community, and whether it's in a given specialty or more importantly, in cross-specialty collaborations, identifying where is the waste. I think I saw that in one of the other questions that came through. Where's the waste? Where is the opportunity to deliver a care experience that's better suited for that patient? And then what systems can we start to build to support that? I mean, sticking with the mental health program example, It was a tough road to build the program because we had to change pen chart. We had a new, billing mechanism. We had to hire new staff and train the new staff in this type of program. But we kept at it. We had sort of a deadline that was externally set and we were committed to. And we together, psychiatry and primary care, plowed through those obstacles. So this doesn't happen with a snap of a finger. This takes some real work, but I do think we'll start to get good at meeting those obstacles, the pen chart challenge, the finance challenge, the impact on incentives that are set up, for providers and others. Those are things we're going to start to get good at meeting, and hopefully we can be even, do this more quickly in a variety of clinical settings.
Love it. Dr. Dan Feinberg, Chief Medical Officer, Pennsylvania Hospital, said, as a system and as a school, we can figure out how to do this well. Vote of confidence. Mitch, Nicole in the chat says that this is a great opportunity to utilize nurses in primary care practices in different ways than we have, and maybe nurses in many practices differently. And can you, and Jeff also writes in, can you comment on the importance of a team-based care in a value-based world?
Oh, I completely agree. And I would say it's not just nurses. It's as Matt alluded to, it's everybody in the office, everybody in the hospital, everybody in the facility. So it's nurses in our world, it's radiology technologists, it's pulmonary respiratory therapists, it's all of the professionals that practice, mental health professionals, others. It's designing care models which, involve, a lot of, and I love the term that Matt used, glue, often that need to connect the patients. I mean, how often do patients get lost in the system? And we have episodes available to them. They're CPT codes that they can access that'll take care of them, but they don't even know how to get to those episodes. They don't know who to see. They don't know how to get referred. They don't know, they don't understand the financial implications. So all that glue that actually connects them and makes our care really impactful, I think, there are huge opportunities for us to leverage our teams.
Neil Ravitz writes in, one of the challenges that he sees, by the way, he is the COO in orthopedics as well as the service line and musculoskeletal service line. One of the challenges that he sees is there are a lot of shared accountabilities for performance and value programs, departments, hospitals, post-acute, home care, therapy. Shared accountability can be tricky. How's Penn Medicine thinking about that challenge? I throw it to either all of you.
Sure, I can start with that. There's great. Certainly a level of reengineering that has to happen at our overall health system to continually better support this model of care, because we have historically operated as not isolated islands. There's always been a lot of collaboration and spirit of collaboration, but at the end of the day, bottom line accountability to individual entities that isn't supported in a that broader team-based, value-based approach. So there's an evolution that's been occurring. There's accountability at the highest levels of the organization to be helping to fertilize the groundswell of that sort of collaboration that has to happen. But at the end of the day, to Matt and Mitch's point, it's about the care teams and making sure that the environment is right for them to do that.
And I think there's a challenge to reengineering the economy, which has been, the economy around here has been so volume focused, right? And reengineering that economy a bit so that we get incentives where we can figure out how we can make both, entity, team, and individual accountability assessments.
Thanks. Roy, let me throw it over to you again. Dave Weinstein asks, can you talk about how we get our payer partners supporting and buying into this across their board? Aren't there going to be some challenges with payers operating in this value-based model versus other payers who are more in the fee-for-service model? How are those challenges going to help?
Sure. Yeah, so let me first start with a little historical perspective. For the last 6 or 7 years, by and large, what we've been doing is saying slow down to the payers around these value-based models. It's not us looking to shake the trees to get payers to be willing to do this. We've been pacing it ourselves so that we can manage this transition better. I don't think there's a payer that we work with that wouldn't welcome us bringing more of this kind of value base, especially the financial risk that goes along with it, into Penn and these agreements. So the real challenge about the plethora of payers that we work with is that each one has their own style of how they want to do it. Mm-hmm. Specific metrics they want to focus on, specific ways of sharing information, different even timing of, you know, is it a calendar year, a fiscal year, those sorts of things are all different. And so we've got two challenges. One, to try and get them as common as we can get them. But more importantly is to pull out the important themes that they all share so that we don't get mired down in all those details. There's no reason to be mired down in all those details. Rather, figure out what the formulas for success are across all of them and go for it.
Awesome. Dr. Rich Wender, our chair of family medicine, asks, can you comment on the goal of striving for equity and health outcomes for all people and how that relates to value-based care? My guess, his guess and mine too, is that the answer is not so simple. Mitch, you want to try that one and then I'll turn it over to you, Matt, if you want to have further comment.
Yeah, I mean, this is always a difficult question, but I think it really relates to focusing on health outcomes. And here's a population that frankly needs perhaps a bit more glue because they may struggle in access. They need a little more flexibility in how we care. They may need types of care that we may not be thinking about in other populations. And so, you know, value-based programs, particularly population management value-based programs, gives us opportunities to bring proactive care to a group that may not be seeking out care, to bring preventive services to groups that may not be seeking out preventive services, and have us incented to do that as opposed to sitting back and waiting for them to see us. So I do think there's definitely a big component of this that helps with providing care to underserved populations.
Any further comment on that, Matt?
No, I agree 100% with Mitch.
I would also add that. Go ahead, Mitch.
I said it's the first time you ever agreed 100% with me.
I would also just add that the conventional insurance mechanisms that cover the underserved or in fact the uninsured altogether, the best opportunity we have to serve them is to figure out how to deliver better health outcomes because they're chronically underfunded by the government, right? So our job would be not to drive volume, right? That makes no sense to drive volume in an underfunded population. It's to find ways to deliver better care more efficiently and actually share in the savings that we can drive from that.
Dr. Wender gives you thumbs up on a good answer. Roy, I want to have you have the last word. Well, maybe it's all of you. Advice for our leaders.
I get the last word.
You like the last word. How and where can leaders learn more if they're not already really seeped in this? What can they be doing to better prepare for this future as we expand our reach of value-based care? In like a minute or less, and I'll ask all three of you.
I get the last word, remember.
All right,
Mitch.
I'll go first.
Matt, go first.
So there are a lot of resources out there. And first of all, email me. I'm passionate about this, as you could probably tell. And if you ever want to talk or want me to send you articles and other sources of information, happy to do that. The one I'll point to, and maybe I'm a little biased because I was involved with the creation of this. I previously worked at Medicare, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. When I was there, we launched a public-private partnership called the Healthcare Payment Learning and Action Network. That doesn't really roll off the tongue, but if you just type in healthcare payment and then LAN, L-A-N, you'll get the website. And the goal of this partnership was to do exactly what Roy just said, which is to try to align payers in the way these programs are implemented to minimize the administrative burden and maximize participation. I will acknowledge that that effort, that goal has been much more challenging than originally anticipated, but this partnership still exists, and their website has several resources to help explain more about value-based care, both on the payment side, if you're into the wonky technical stuff, but also on the care delivery side, if you're interested in more information related to how we can innovate our care models. I also think at the end of the day, that innovation is going to come from the front lines, the people who are on our care teams, who know where we need glue, and then we need to build the systems around them to turn those ideas into actionable programs.
Thanks. Mitch, in like 15 seconds, any other advice for leaders?
Just be a student. Lots of resources, as Matt said, and just be a student and get involved in conversations and pay attention to what's going on around you.
Roy, I promised you the last word, but it really only can be like two words.
That's two words. My office often does in services around fee for service. We've actually haven't started doing it on value based, but I think that's a terrific idea for my group to be able to start providing some in services on what the programs are at Penn, how they operate, and how your specific area could contribute.
If people are into that, PMA could help you, Roy. We have some good ideas around how we teach some of this stuff. So with your expertise, maybe we could have a good partnership. Well, I can't thank the three of you enough for your leadership, for your generosity, and sharing your thoughts and advice. Roy, Mitch, Matt, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you all in the audience for such great questions. I know I didn't get to all of them, but we'll be sharing those with our panelists, so you may be hearing back from us. So listen, our next show, October 21st, Empowering the Penn Medicine Experience. We are pumped in the run-up to the Penn Medicine Experience Week, and we're lucky enough to have Craig Lowndes, Dr. Krista Shiashetti, and Tracy Comack, Bradner. You'll want to be here. We got a lot to talk about, is about empowering the Penn Medicine Experience and how our patient experience continues to evolve. Pull up your outlooks. We've got great shows coming. November 4th, we are going to talk about navigating career transitions. You won't want to miss that one either. We're also going to talk about leading to improved community health with Dr. Wender, who is here today. Carmen Guerra, Alice Yoder, that's November 18th, December 2nd, December 16th. We're going to finish this year strong, Lunch with Leaders style. Now, listen, if you missed a show, don't forget you can watch the replay on podcast or on the replay, because it's new to you. Lead Strong page has all of those connections, as well as the PowerPoint slides and the chat. We love your feedback. We love hearing your ideas for shows. So please fill out the survey to let us know how we keep meeting your needs at Lunch with Leaders. I want to thank the team, hashtag Dream Team. Special thanks to Rob for his technical prowess. Make sure to exit the poll. And thank each of you. Really, thank you. I see you. We all see you. It's not easy to be a leader right now. It's definitely not for the faint of heart. So in community, we can get through everything. So I really thank you for all that you continue to do to lead during these tricky times. And I'm really grateful. So as long as we stick together, we're going to get through it. So I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. In the meantime, take good care.